from KXJZ in Sacramento. This is Inside. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, two musical guests, very different music. One is a trumpeter, Matthew Mackey, who's from the Sacramento area, now in the classical music big league. He's with the New York Philharmonic, but he's back home for a concert this weekend with the Sacramento Philharmonic. We'll also hear from local popular children's entertainer, Music Mike. First, is playing football bad for the brain? A local medical examiner caused a stir recently in the sports world with his discovery of a serious brain injury caused by football. The National Football League reacted with caution but formed a group to study brain injury in retired players. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a couple of local college athletic trainers. But first, the man behind the study. He's Dr. Bennett Omalu, the recently hired chief medical examiner for San Joaquin County. At the time of his study, he was a neuropathologist at the University of Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania. Dr. Bennett Omalu, welcome to Insight.
Thank you so much, Jeffrey.
What is this brain injury that you found in some people who play football?
Well, this is a chronic, irreversible brain damage caused by repeated concussions or repeated mild traumatic brain injury. Over a long period, they would develop a dementia. They lose their intellectual functioning. They lose their cognitive functioning. They develop major depression and develop violent tendencies.
How serious a condition would you describe it? When someone has this condition at an advanced stage, how much does it impair their ability to live normally?
That's a significant impairment. They become demented. Like the most common type of dementia is Alzheimer's disease. They become like almost Alzheimer's disease patients. They become broke, lose their ability to manage money. They lose their ability to think critically. They become depressed. Some of them may attempt suicide. In fact, may actually complete suicides, kill themselves, and may actually become a threat to their next of kin and family members. So it's a very serious condition.
How did you find this condition? Were you looking for it as an academic researcher, or did you just happen upon it as a neuropathologist?
So it was by serendipity, accident discovery, because this was the first case was in Mike Webster in 2012. I was doing my regular day-to-day work. But because of my knowledge in sports pathology, their brains may appear normal on CT scan, on MRI, even on direct naked eye examination. But I was not fooled because I knew what the literature said. I had to subject their brains to very highly sophisticated tissue analysis using specific types of antibodies. And then the antibodies will identify the accumulations of abnormal proteins in the brain. And when you magnify the brains to about 600 to 1,000 times, you would see the abnormal protein forms in their brains with loss of brain cells.
You said your knowledge of sports pathology. What do you mean by that? Is this something you've specialized in?
Yes, I have about 7 degrees, so almost a composite qualification. I'm a forensic pathologist and also a neuropathologist and also an epidemiologist. So I kind of invested my knowledge in all these areas, combined them together to derive this unquestionable value proposition. So had it been that I was just a forensic pathologist, I may not have had the knowledge to investigate this disease.
Do you have a background playing football or some similar sport?
Ironically, originally I came from Nigeria. I never played football. I did not know so much about football, but I think it was actually advantageous for me because I was able to look at it objectively without any subjective bias. And so I was as objective as I could be. No, I don't have any experience with football. But I know that football is a high-impact contact sport, that some players during the play of football may be subjected to forces that are up to 120 times, if not more, of the force of gravity. So these repeated impacts to the brain, though seemingly innocuous, with time would result in chronic, irreversible brain damage in your midlife.
My guest is Dr. Bennett Omalu. He's the chief medical examiner of San Joaquin County. He just arrived last month. He's also the author of a study on brain injuries resulting from playing football. How do you know that the condition you have observed was caused by football?
Yes, it's a generally accepted principle in medicine, and it's common knowledge that repeated concussions would give you a specific type. I would use the word pathognomonic, meaning definitive pathologic findings. It's been established since 1928, if not earlier, that repeated concussions or repeated impacts on the brain will give you a specific type of dementia. And we have a definitive tissue structure, abnormal tissue structure. Originally, it was discovered first in boxers, the so-called dementia pugilistica. So the pathology, the tissue evidence, definitive tissue evidence that this was due to repeated concussions and subconcussions. So it's already established in the medical literature. It's a generally accepted principle and it's common knowledge.
We invited the National Football League to take part in this discussion, but we haven't yet been able to receive confirmation that someone could or would take part in our conversation. But in an article in Popular Science, a doctor who is co-chairman of the NFL's Mild Traumatic Brain Injury Committee was quoted as saying, "No one is dismissing the work," referring to your study, Dr. Bennett Omalu's study, "but there are numerous inconsistencies and inaccuracies. We refuse to jump on the bandwagon with the first report." How do you respond to that?
Now, this is not a first, but again, I must emphasize I was the individual who examined Chris Benoit's brain. So this is not about football. This is about public safety. This is about concussions. You could find it in wrestlers, you could find it in boxers, you could find it in any individual who suffers repeated blows to his head over time. So I must emphasize, this is not about football. The relationship between my findings, and it's just one study, I've identified this disease in Mike Webster, in Terry Long, in Andrew Waters, and now Chris Benoit, and Justin Streisling. In fact, there's a paper, another paper that will be published in Neurosurgery Journal very soon that has is a case series. So there's mounting medical evidence. It's not inaccurate. It's not, there are no inconsistencies. This is very well established in the literature. Most other doctors, in fact, there was a paper by Dr. Cantu recently in the Neurosurgery Journal. Dr. Cantu is the world's authority in concussions. Dr. Cantu has confirmed our findings, and I've actually wondered why are some doctors, some a group of specific doctors, disputing our findings. This is unquestionable, indisputable medical evidence.
What do you think the NFL and college football teams should do?
Well, the first and foremost is first identify what the problem is. The CDC has identified it because they're over 3 million concussions and subconcussions are sports-related in this country every year, identified as a public safety issue, as a public health issue, then bring groups of experts together. I think we've gone beyond the stage of denial. We need to recognize this disease and bring brilliant people together and define a prophylactic preventive measures and, if possible, therapeutic interventional measures. What we should do first, identify it as a problem. I'm publishing a book in February after the Super Bowl on concussions. We must identify it. We must educate ourselves, educate the players to identify concussions and subconcussions. Then we move forward from there. But once you keep on denying that it's not an issue, then we would never move forward.
Dr. Bennett Omalu is chief medical examiner of San Joaquin County. He's also the author of a study on brain injuries resulting from contact sports like football. We're going to talk now with two local athletic trainers at colleges. Steve DeHart is athletic trainer for the Hornets football team at Sacramento State, and Jeff Hogan is the head athletic trainer at UC Davis. Steve, Jeff, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, sir.
I'd like to hear from both of you first, but let's start with Steve. Steve, do you think that the football establishment, college and NFL, is in denial about the risk of brain injury?
Oh, no, not at all. I think it's a very real concern that we deal with every day and deal with it in a way that is appropriate to the kids and young men that we are working with. The National Athletic Trainers Association has a position statement on the management of sports-related concussions that goes through very specifically the real concern that we're dealing with on an everyday basis, not just with football, but with other sports like soccer, lacrosse that we're seeing, anything you can get any sort of head injury in contact with. So no, it's a very real thing, and it is something that has been looked at and continues to be looked at as we speak.
What exactly do you do to protect the brains of the young men or in the football team?
Right. Well, you know, football is a contact sport. The equipment, I think, is getting better. As we speak, there are now football helmets that have measuring devices within them that indicate levels of trauma on specific parts of the brain. So I think that the technology is moving along greatly. On my level, the cost of that is a little bit more than I am able to deal with. So what do we deal with if we don't have the money for that? I think it's getting to know your athletes, making sure you're looking for all the signs and symptoms of concussions. As being an athletic trainer, we are around these kids every time they are on the field and are watching over them with not just my eyes, but all of my assistants' eyes as well. So it's a matter if you see something that's out of the ordinary and that you take a very conservative approach toward it, and that it can certainly be dealt with. And if you do suspect any sort of a mild concussion, that you pull somebody off the playing field.
Jeff Hogan, how do you handle this issue with the athletes at UC Davis?
Well, very, very similar to what Steve just described. It's lots of observation and probably most importantly is education. We constantly talk to our athletes about the effects of mild traumatic brain injury and that it cannot be taken lightly. The days of just being dinged and not worrying about it are over. We are learning all the time new things about the brain and how it reacts to injury. And probably the success that I enjoy with treating our athletes is almost solely based on the fact that we rely on educating them and gaining their trust so that they'll communicate to us. And if they do become injured, they will not fear being yanked and not having a fair opportunity to return to play. So it's communicating, and then once they are injured, we measure them. We get our team physicians involved and monitor them extremely close.
Is there an old school contingent, whether among coaches, trainers, players, alumni, who put pressure on the athletes to take more chances than perhaps they should with their brain health, Jeff Hogan?
Well, there definitely was. That is becoming less so as newer coaches come into to the work world here. I know that our coaches, some of them have been around in excess of 30 years in this program at UC Davis, are not that way, and it's because they just have kept up with the literature. They listen to what we have to say, what our docs have to say. And I think more and more, if you ask athletic trainers at the collegiate level, they'll all say that those days are virtually over with. Coaches and other medical care people are not going to be that cavalier about head injuries.
Steve, do you know people who clearly have some kind of brain injury today as a result of playing sports when they were younger?
I've seen it happen too many times, and once is too many. When you do play a high velocity sport, especially like football, which I played as well at the collegiate level, these things are going to happen. You just want to really minimize the effects of it. Have I known personally anybody that has had a cognitive dysfunction due to it? No. I think that part of that is because, like Jeff speaks about, is the educational process of letting the kids know that I think nowadays kids are, if they start to feel off a little bit, that there has been so much media placed in a proper position that they are concerned of it as well. And if we can educate them and show them that, when they have these so-called little dings, that they're not normal, then they can go ahead and take the proper steps along with the athletic trainer and the medical professionals, along with associated with the team, and take care of the issues, stay out, become asymptomatic for a good period of time, raise their activity level to where they can participate without hitting, without feeling any symptoms, and then progressing from there.
But Jeff Hogan, if we take a hypothetical situation, but it's certainly possible, if you got a star, promising football player who just seems to be prone to getting concussions, I would imagine that, you know, you're under pressure to have the teams perform at the highest level. There's money involved, the scholarships involved, there's prestige involved. Is there anything that insulates you or the coaches to make the decision to pull someone permanently from the football team?
Well, fortunately, that pressure I've not experienced here at this program. I have had to pull an All-American football player in our playoffs. And the only question the coach asked me was, would he possibly be ready next week? The coaches here, and I'm sure Steve will say the same with his coaching staff, that they all understand this is not in their decision anymore. It's the medical staff's decision, and our team doctors have the absolute final word on who plays and who doesn't. And at least I can say personally, there's been no arguments about that.
Final question for both of you, Steve DeHart and Jeff Hogan. Is there anything that still needs to be done, ideally, to protect the brain health of football players that's not being done today or not being done enough? And Jeff, feel free to expand it to other contact sports where the brain is at risk. Let's start with Steve DeHart at Sacramento State.
Yeah, no, I think the main thing is education. It's letting the kids know, letting the coaches know that this is a very real concern and can have lasting effects. And it's nothing to play around with whatsoever. Also, they need to know that there is no pressure for them to put themselves at risk that's going to cause potential long-term damage. And I think at Sac State, I have the same relationship with the coaches here that Jeff has described. And if we can educate better, I think we'll have better results.
Jeff Hogan at UC Davis.
Well, in addition to that, I think there's still the stigma with athletes, with young kids, that if something different needs to be worn to protect them and it's not the normal equipment, they get teased. And I think there needs to be a more of an emphasis about protection. Soccer, for instance, there's some devices out there that are being looked at, worn by some individuals to help protect or minimize injury due to hitting the ball. And yet when folks are wearing those, you'll hear comments by the other athletes. So that is a tough thing for us to break through, is to convince a kid to wear something that is not normal standard equipment, and therefore they stand out and receive extra attention that's not necessarily positive. Other than that, it's the technology it's there, it's coming along, it's just pricey. And once things become more mainstream and we can afford to do the things that the NFL is able to do, as an example, in football, we'll be doing really well. It's like everything. It's a matter of research and development.
When you talk about expensive technology, are you talking about special helmets?
That is one, as well as returning to play. Just how much has that brain been injured, and when is it healthy enough to return is a very, very difficult decision for everybody. And right now, MRIs, as Dr. Amalu mentioned earlier, most of these come out negative, and you have to have specialized high technologic devices that will pick up some of the abnormalities that do exist. Unfortunately, not everybody has these devices, these machines available in their in their hospitals.
Well, thank you both very much. Jeff Hogan, head athletic trainer at UC Davis, and Steve DeHart, athletic trainer for the Hornets football team at Sacramento State. And thanks also to our earlier guest, Dr. Bennett Omalu, chief medical examiner of San Joaquin County, the author of a study on brain injuries resulting from contact sports like football. He had to leave us a little earlier. Thank you all very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Bye. Thank you, sir.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, trumpeter Matthew Mucky. He plays for the New York Philharmonic. He was raised in these parts. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. A new charter school in West Sacramento gives students the chance to earn 30 college credits before they even graduate from high school. Tomorrow in Insight, you'll learn about the school and hear what university researchers hope to learn there. Plus, the life of the late Noel Coward. It's told in a musical review this week in Sacramento. Englishman Coward was a witty actor, writer, and composer. There is a musical homecoming this weekend in Sacramento. Trumpeter Matthew Mucky is from the Elk Grove area, but nowadays he lives 3,000 miles away, working in the classical music big league. He's the number two trumpeter at the New York Philharmonic, one of the world's top orchestras. But this week, Matthew's back home for a concert with the Sacramento Philharmonic. He's in our studio with his trumpet. Matthew, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
How did you get started playing the trumpet? You were not a trumpeter when you first started in music, I hear.
No, I first started playing the piano when I was fairly young, about when I was in kindergarten, and my mother was my teacher, and I played the piano for until 10th grade, but I started the trumpet when I was 9 years old, and my parents said, you know, why don't you take up a second instrument? And the instrument of choice was the trumpet. So,
well, there's a big difference between the trumpet and the piano. Hard to think of two instruments more different from each other in a way. How did you feel when you picked up the trumpet for the first time?
Oh, it was so long ago. I don't remember, but, you know, I just remember. The one thing I do remember is that, you know, it was just such a, it could be such a loud and such a, hey, I'm here type of instrument, but it can also be an extremely beautiful and extremely expressive instrument as well.
Why the trumpet?
I don't know. my parents, you know, I have a history of brass playing in my family, and we had a trumpet. My mom was actually a trumpet minor in college. She was a piano major, and so it seemed fitting for me to play the trumpet since we had trumpets around. And
yeah, how good were you at the piano?
I was okay. I was pretty good for my age. Piano is an extremely competitive instrument. I did do well at one competition. I placed in a Music Teachers Association of California. I won first prize at one event, and that was pretty special because, you know, I was playing the trumpet and the piano, and I could, you know, claim that I could maybe do it on both instruments for at least a little while.
What do you think would have happened if you hadn't been introduced to the trumpet as your, quote, second instrument? Would you still have played the piano? Do you think you'd be a professional musician today?
Oh, you never know. I mean, you never know how things are going to turn out. I'm really glad I ended up playing the trumpet. I love the trumpet. I think it's definitely very fitting of my personality.
Oh, yeah? Tell us about that. Why is it fitting for your personality?
Oh, I think it's just, I mean, it's very, it's outgoing. But it also can be very compassionate. And,
yeah?
Yeah.
Well, you have your trumpet with us.
I do, yes.
Feel free to play something for us.
Okay. I guess I'll play a little bit of the concerto that I'm playing this weekend.
With the Sacramento Philharmonic. What is the concerto?
The concerto is the Oscar Bema. Bema was German, and he was a German trumpeter, and it's a romantic trumpet concerto.
Okay, and so you're going to play a bit of it for us.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll play a couple notes.
Minus the orchestra.
Yes. This is part of the first movement. That's part of the first movement, this part of the second movement.
Very nice.
And in the third movement, there's, you know, it's a different type of style. It's very, it's like a dance.
Thank you very much. That's Matthew Mucky. He's a trumpeter, originally from the Elk Grove area. He plays now with the New York Philharmonic, and he's back home this week for a concert this Saturday with the Sacramento Philharmonic. And we just got a little sneak preview of some of the solo passages he'll be playing from Boehme's Trumpet Concerto. What's the difference between standing at the front of the orchestra, being a soloist, and being in the part of the core of the orchestra where you're playing along with maybe 100 other musicians?
I think it's a definite comfort level thing. When I'm sitting in the back of the orchestra, I feel like it's one big family and we're all making this beautiful music together. And, I mean, when you're a soloist, you're also making music with the group, but you're also... you have sort of a duty to send a musical message to the audience and to try to convey some type of emotion. Mm-hmm. And I feel like one of the most memorable things I did this year with the New York Philharmonic is I played Handel's Messiah. And there's a big solo with, it's called The Trumpet Shall Sound. And I stood up in front of the New York Philharmonic, and this is within the first 2 or 3 months of working for them, and I stood up there and I just played it, and it was great. It was just a great feeling.
What do the musicians in an orchestra say about the soloist when some soloist arrives and stands with the back to the orchestra and gets all the attention?
Oh, well, I think we're generally pretty supportive of whoever is playing with us. You know, yeah. The quality of musicians that we get with the New York Philharmonic is quite amazing. And I've seen so many great soloists pass through so far. I mean, I think we're most of the time we're like, yeah, they're really nailing it.
How old are you?
I'm 23 years old.
Well, when I think about when I see orchestras, it seems like most of the people are older than 23. Sure. Are you on the young side in the orchestra?
Yes. As of now, I'm the youngest member of the New York Philharmonic. And in the brass section... I'm also relatively young compared to the other. I think the next youngest in the brass section is 33 years old.
When you were still at high school with the Sacramento Youth Symphony, mm-hmm. would you have dreamt that in your early 20s you'd be a regular member of the New York Philharmonic?
You know, it was always an ongoing dream. I could never expect it to happen, but I could work as hard as I could, always practice and, you know, try to achieve my dream.
Well, speaking about back in those days, you were on the NPR show From the Top.
Right.
This was about 6 years ago. How old were you then? About 17?
I was 17 years old, yeah.
Okay. And you made a bit of a splash then. You played, you probably remember it well, Arban's Carnival of Venice.
Yes.
And it's a tough piece to play, isn't it?
It's tricky.
Yes, it is. Well, we're going to hear the very end of it, and then you can tell us what's tricky about it. Here's Matthew Mucky on the NPR show From the Top about 6 years ago. And I counted it. The audience was clapping and cheering for 25 seconds, which is a long time on a radio show. What's so hard about that?
Well,
multiple things, I think.
Yeah. Well, the tricky part about that variation in general is that you're trying to bring out the melody, but you're also playing three notes in between each melody. You know, so you're trying to play two parts at once.
So that's why it sounds like two trumpets.
Yes.
But it's really just one.
Yep.
And then at the very end, that sounds like a high note on the trumpet.
It's relatively high, yeah.
Yeah. What note is it?
It's a concert E flat or on a B flat trumpet, a high F.
Well, the very knowledgeable audience From the Top were oohing and aahing when they heard that you were going to play the high F. So they obviously thought that that was a big deal. Is it hard to generate high notes or any note on a trumpet compared to, say, a piano?
I would definitely say that compared to a piano, with a piano you just press down and it comes out. On a trumpet, it's the physics of your lips producing the vibrations capable of the high note. It requires a lot of muscle. It requires a lot of airspeed.
It seems to me that, well, obviously the piano, all the notes are laid out in front of you. But even with a violin, you see the fretboard in front of you, and you can tell pretty well, I guess, where the notes come. Same with the guitar. But with the trumpet, it seems more abstract where the notes are inside of the instrument. Do you know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I can see what you mean. I think much like the violin, the trumpet is it's based a lot on muscle memory. And like a violinist will remember where they put down their finger, I remember in what way I press my lips together to produce a sound.
How can you produce so many notes with an instrument that just has three valves?
Well, it's the way that most brass, all brass instruments work. It's the overtone series, and it's how a bugle can play reveille. It's the overtone series, which allows us to produce multiple notes on the overtone series.
What's the overtone series?
It's just
you could be asking
physics
for trouble
of a tube.
Here.
Yeah. No, it's the physics of any tube. Like with one fingering, I can play. And you can, and as you get higher,
you didn't move any fingers.
Move any fingers, but as I got higher, the notes get closer and closer together.
Are you changing the shape of your mouth when you're doing that?
Slightly, yes.
So just slight change in the mouth can make all those radically different notes?
Yes.
Wow. How many notes can you play in a trumpet?
All of them.
All of them. And more. It seems to me that when I'm listening to an orchestra, I get a little nervous sometimes when the trumpeter is loud and playing a solo, because it seems like it can be so loud and so assertive that a mistake can literally ring out in the auditorium, probably louder than just about any other instrument. Is that right?
Right. That could be that's the risk of the instrument. I think for brass and percussion, you know, you basically have to just lay it on the line and go for it. Either you hit it and it'll be really great, or you don't hit it and it won't be so great. But you have to have that confidence to go for it.
So is there a bit more of a gamble when you're pushing for that big note on a trumpet than there is on some other instruments?
Probably more gamble for a trumpet than there would be maybe for a clarinet, because for them it's more based on the fingering, and it's not as based on an overtone series where it's so close together. But I think actually when I feel like I'm going for a note, I'm more likely to get it because I'm confident that it'll come out.
My guest is Matthew Mucky. He's a trumpeter from originally the Elk Grove area. He plays with the New York Philharmonic, and he's back home this week for a concert this Saturday evening with the Sacramento Philharmonic. He's the soloist in a performance of Burma's Trumpet Concerto. How often do you come back to this part of the world?
As often as I can. We have a very busy schedule at the New York Philharmonic, but I really like coming back. The weather is much better during the winter. Obviously, it's not, you know, raining, or it's not snowing and windy all the time, but I like to see my parents and old friends.
What really helped you when you were young, learning the trumpet, learning to be a musician? Because you learned under various people, you played in some youth orchestras and so on. Your mother obviously was heavily involved. What was the most important thing in your youth that helped you get to where you are today as a 23-year-old in the New York Philharmonic?
I think you know, all the training I had in music, it definitely helped with, you know, the teaching of discipline, and, you know, just knowing how to be disciplined with what you do, and to always work at what you want to achieve.
I know it might seem premature to ask this question because you're only in your early 20s and you already have a regular job with the New York Philharmonic, but looking into the future, do you see anything else for you, or does this look like this is where you want to be?
Well, I know this is where I want to be right now. It's a fantastic orchestra. It's a fantastic job opportunity for me. I'm absolutely thrilled to be playing with the people that I play with on the job. They're all fantastic musicians, and right now I'm living a dream.
Yeah, I bet. And how did it come about that you're playing with the Sacramento Philharmonic? Did you go to them and say, "Hey, I'd love to be a soloist with you," or was it the other way around?
Well, I've worked with Michael Morgan before.
He's a conductor and the music director of the Sacramento Philharmonic.
Yeah, and I played the Carnival of Venice with the Sacramento Philharmonic before, and shortly after I won this position, I got a call from the Sacramento Philharmonic asking if I would want to come back to my hometown and play a solo with the orchestra. And I was absolutely thrilled and happy to come back.
And what's it going to be like when you step out onto the community center theater stage on Saturday evening?
Oh, I think it'll be amazing. I think it'll be great. I'll be a little nervous to be playing for all my friends and family, but I hope it goes well.
Well, the hometown crowd is going to be happy to see you.
Yeah, I'll be happy to see them too.
Well, thanks so much for coming in today. I know you got a lot on your plate this week, but thanks for taking time to come to our studio.
Thank you.
It's Matthew Mucky, trumpeter with the New York Philharmonic, and this week with the Sacramento Philharmonic. He's a soloist this Saturday evening. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, we'll talk with local children's entertainer Music Mike. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can listen to Insight live online. To stream our show, go to capradio.org/insight. One of Sacramento's most popular children's entertainers is Music Mike. He's a singer and guitarist who entertains kids at birthday parties and in concerts at community centers. He has a gig tonight in Rockland. He's in our studio with his guitar. Music Mike, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
How did you get started playing music for kids?
It kind of fell in my lap. I started out playing basically your solo gigs, maybe playing in pubs and doing a variety of stuff like that. And I thought, hey, you know, I could take this and maybe work with seniors, kids. It kind of opened up some new avenues for me to go down. So I kind of slowly started working with the children. And over the last 18 years now, I've been working with children.
What kind of music were you playing before you specialized in kids?
Actually, I spent the 80s in Hollywood rocking out.
Well, you still have the hair.
I still have the hair. I still love to play the electric guitar. I just love playing the guitar. So working with the kids is just a great way for me to perform and do what I love to do. Maybe it's not rock and roll, but I get the same reaction.
What kind of songs do you play? Do you do your own songs? Do you do well-known songs or both?
I do anything that the kids like. So if I write a song and the kids like it, I perform it for them. I play folk songs. I play old rock and roll songs. I pretty much experiment and try all kinds of stuff. So it's not really limited to one facet of music.
My guest is Music Mike. What's the most enjoyable thing about playing for kids?
You know, what's so nice about it is they're so open and they're so free. And I'm kind of the same way. I just like to be free in what I do. And just to see their faces light up every day when I walk in the room. And they're so outgoing. And it's just a fun place to be.
What's the key to entertaining children?
I think it takes a lot of different little things. You got to have patience. As far as me, I just love to play music and share it. So you got to really want to share your music. You know, I add a little bit of comedy in there. You know, you can't be too dull and do this job. You have to, you have to be on time. You have to, you know, there's some work involved in there, but, I don't know. You just gotta like to have a lot of fun.
You're gonna play a song for us. What song are you gonna play?
This song's called "I Love Music."
Yeah, sounds nice.
When I was a little boy, just about 3, I'd show my mom and dad how silly I could be. I'd put on a funny song, you know, one with the drum beat. Jump around like a crazy rabbit, hopping on my 2 feet, and I'd hop.
'cause I love music that beats so strong. I love music. It's in my heart, it's in my song. Now that I'm older and happy as can be, I play the guitar and the words I sing. I love rock and roll and country, classical and jazz, and anything in between that makes me want to dance, and I dance. 'Cause I love music that beats so strong. It's in my heart, it's in my song.
That's great. That's fun. I Love Music by my guest, Music Mike, the longtime and popular local children's entertainer. He has a concert tonight in Rockland. Do you like to get the kids to sing along?
Yeah, it's a little bit different because I work with kids from basically 2 to 6. So I'm not really singing. Well, we do sing songs together, but a lot of it is kind of music and movement. So I will sing a verse or two, but normally it's a lot of maybe just a quick little sing-along and some jumping around, and, you know, I keep them on the move.
Yeah. What's the difference between what you do at a birthday party and what you do at a concert?
Birthday parties, what's nice about the concerts is there's a lot of room, so they can move around a little more, do some running, and kind of do a little bit of different stuff. But I don't know, it just depends on the situation. I've been doing this for 18 years, so I kind of look at the situation and kind of go with what kind of room I have and how many kids, how old the kids are. There's a lot of variables.
Do you have to adopt a persona when you arrive at the birthday party? Do you have to change who you are when you're not Music Mike?
No, that's one thing I've tried to keep what I do basically real. I don't dress up. I don't play a character. I'm basically a musician, and I'm just basically trying to show the kids, you know, that a real side to a musician.
Yeah. You mentioned that before you became a children's entertainer, you were down in Southern California rocking out. Tell us a bit more about what you were doing then.
I was basically in a hard rock band, and I was a lead singer and lead guitar player. And we played quite a few gigs in Hollywood and the surrounding areas and stuff. It was all original music. And that's kind of where I really learned how to write songs and entertain, and I think through that experience I really learned, came into where I wanted to entertain for a living.
Yeah. What kind of music do you listen to nowadays?
I'm still rocking out. I love rock music. I guess my favorite music's like 80s rock, I guess, yeah.
Like, who's your favorite?
Actually, about a year and a half ago, I got to meet the singer in Whitesnake. I really like David Coverdale.
Oh, he's a big name.
I really like just that bluesy kind of rock. I just love, and more than anything, I just love the guitar music. You know, I just love guitar. So,
Do you ever play music like that nowadays?
When I go home today, I'll probably play some music like that.
Yeah. But not on stage, though.
No, well, it's just there's not the venues anymore, you know. It's... what's nice is I can go home and plug in my guitar and play whatever I want, have the tone I like, and I'm kind of spoiled that way. And then what's nice with the kids is I go out and I entertain, work with the kids during the day, and it kind of takes all the need to go out and actually hit the stage. So.
I mentioned your hair earlier. For people who haven't seen you as Music Mike, you've got pretty long hair. It goes down to your shoulders, even beyond. I mean, that was that the same hairstyle you had when you were in the rock band in the 80s?
I've had this hair forever. I don't know what it is. It just comes along with the guitar, I guess.
Does it work as music, Mike, too? I mean, is that something that you think works for you as a children's entertainer?
It's kind of funny because I don't really think about it. You know, it's just kind of there, and it moves with the music or whatever, but I'm just not into... I don't know. I'm not into hiding behind anything or anything, so it's just part of me, I guess.
Yeah. We talked about what's most enjoyable about entertaining kids. What's the biggest challenge?
I think the biggest challenge is to keep it fresh, you know. The hardest, you know, you can go in every day and sing Old MacDonald, and it gets a little bit old, so... You have to keep changing the songs up, keep moving around, because it's basically a show on the road. You know, you can't, it can get stale and you can burn out. So I try to keep it fresh. That's the hardest part.
Kids can be quite conservative in their tastes. Do they still like Old MacDonald and so on just as many times as they can hear it? Or are they open to new songs and new sounds?
Well, you know what's nice about a song like Old MacDonald? It brings everyone together. And it's like any song. You go watch a band, and if they sing a song that everybody in the audience knows, there's an energy there. So singing Old MacDonald or whatever brings everyone together and everyone's singing along and working together, it's a hit.
Yeah. And can you see yourself doing this well off into the future?
You know what's funny is... I do this when I'm not doing it. So I am playing my guitar when I wake up in the morning on Sunday morning. It doesn't matter. So I might as well go out and share my music with the kids or whoever. So I think I will be doing it.
Indeed. Okay. Well, Music Mike, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a real pleasure.
All right. Thank you.
Music Mike, the long time, 18-year-long, popular local children's entertainer. He has a concert tonight in Rockland at the Sunset Center. There's more information on our webpage, campradio.org/insight. And that's Insight for today. In general, for more information about the guests and topics in our show, go to campradio.org/insight. Coming up on KXJZ, the strike at Chrysler, and the rest of the day's business news, it's next on Marketplace. Today's associate producers were Linnea Edmire and Candice Mangouche. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. Charter School in West Sacramento gives students the chance to earn 30 college credits before they even graduate from high school. On the next Insight, you'll learn about the school and hear what university researchers hope to learn there. Plus, the life of the late Noel Coward, it's told in a musical review this week in Sacramento. Englishman Coward was a witty actor, writer, and composer. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow afternoon at 2 on KXJZ.